Tereway Lel Shishi, Oyle Kavches, Ada Aleph, Thursday, 27th of February. Parshas Pekudei, Rabbi Jeremy Gog.
Good evening, Rabbi Yisai. Parshas Pekudei is actually a tricky parsha to speak about. This four of the last five Shabbos have been dealing with the Mishkan. But Baruch Hashem, I've found some interesting material, which hopefully will be new to some, if not all. The first piece is something I found in the writings of Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein. You may be familiar with his works, Vaharevna and other Svarim. He seems to attract some very strange and interesting questions. And what we'll see tonight is certainly an example of that. The connection, let me tell you the facts first and then I'll tell you the connections to the Pasha. Maybe you can figure it out. True story. A young couple are dating. They go on a shidduch. And all seems to be going very well. They go out several times and they're heading towards getting engaged. But as things progress, the girl comes home. She's updating her parents. And she says to her parents, he's looking very good and it's hopeful that we're going to get engaged. And I suspect he might propose soon. And the father says to her, listen, you know that my hobby, my pastime, is graphology. I like analyzing handwriting. Before this young man proposes, if he does, I insist that I want to see his handwriting. Because I want to analyze what sort of fellow he is. You're my daughter. I want to know. So she's a bit taken aback. And what's more, she's now got to go and tell the poor fellow that he's got to submit some sort of sample handwriting so that the future prospective father-in-law can ascertain his credentials. She tells him, as you can imagine, he's not very happy about it. And what's more, his parents are even less happy about it. But he doesn't want to lose things because he's also quite keen and he's keen to get engaged. So the guy does what he's got to do and he gives her a sample of his handwriting. And she presents it to her father, and the father looks at it and says, wow, this fellow is a fantastic guy. Sterling qualities, fantastic middos, good characteristics. He can see from the handwriting. Fine. Things progress even more, and the fellow is ready to propose. But he's carrying a very heavy burden. He goes to his Rav, and he tells his Rav, the day before he's planning to propose, this is what happened. I'm dating this young lady, everything's going very well, the father-in-law insists on seeing my handwriting. We give handwriting, he likes it very much. So what's the problem, says the Rav? The problem is that it wasn't my handwriting. I went to the best guy in yeshiva, and I said to him, listen, I don't know if he asked him, if he told him, if he's the best guy in yeshiva, maybe he didn't tell him. And he said to him, could you do a favor, could you just write something out for me? And he took the handwriting of the best boy in yeshiva, the boy with the sterling middos and the biggest masmid, and he gave it to this young lady, and he passed it off as if it was his own handwriting. What do I do? He says to his Rav. The Rav says, I don't know. It's the first time I've been asked that question. I need to ask someone with more experience than me. And the question ends up on the desk of Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein. Okay? Now, before we analyze the question, I'm curious just to know a quick poll. How many people here think that the young man is obliged to tell the parents-in-law, tell his prospective kala, and submit his own handwriting? Who thinks here, show of hands, who thinks that he's got to do that, he's got to come clean? Gnevis das. So we think yes? Who thinks that it's not necessary? Benji? Definitely not necessary. Why?
The other side.
It's one of those things.
What?
It's
one of those things.
There's things like you can lie about your age, some things that just aren't important, they fall by the wayside at the end of it.
Well, for the father-in-law, this is very important.
But he wasn't married.
For the girl, it's not important. Okay. So Rav Zilberstein said the following. He said a very interesting thing. He said, look, lechat chila, for sure what you did is not right. It's gnevus hadas, there's shadows of shekev, hainah, fraud, and it's not right. Yeah, Rabbi Yashav once, Rabbi Hartman's got a lovely story one time, I'm not going to go into the details, but he once wanted to bring something into the country. At the time, he was a young yeshiva bacher, he was a yosem, and he needed to bring something in, and it was, he wouldn't disclose it. He was selling like a big ghetto blaster. Yeah, in those days, you bring bread straw, you could sell them for a lot of money, and basically you could keep him in yeshiva for another year. And he was, and it was maise, it was, if he thought it was mutter, and if he was worried about Chil Hashem, he said, don't worry, I'm going to put shorts and t-shirts on, and I'm going to look not like yeshiva bocher, and I'll go through customs dressed like that. But he wasn't sure if it was okay, so he went to Rabbi Yashav. This is going back 40 odd years. And Rabbi Yashav simply said, would the Chofetz Chaim have done that? Now, obviously, you can't picture the Chofetz Chaim, yeah, in shorts and t-shirts with this going through. He wouldn't have done that. That was the answer. So it's not a nice thing to do. It's not lachatchila. Certainly, shouldn't have done it. It's gnevas das. It's dishonest. Yeah, we sometimes need reminders of honesty. We had a few weeks ago in the base where I teach. I have the privilege to teach in the mornings. We had a fellow from Merkas HaTorah, the yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. So he came to. He was there recruiting. So we were sitting with him at breakfast, and he was telling us an amazing thing. We asked him about his. He knew Reb Kreisworth, the great Reb Kreisworth. So we were talking about his memories of him, and he told us a remarkable story. That if you know the yeshiva, Merkas HaTorah, the Nossi of the yeshiva was Reb Kreisworth. Now, he was, of course, the chief rabbi of Antwerp. He lived in Antwerp. But he was sort of the figurehead of the yeshiva. And he came to the yeshiva every month or two, whatever the arrangement was, and he would give shiurim there. But he wasn't the sort of the day-to-day Rosh Yeshiva. The day-to-day Rosh Yeshiva was Reb Rotman. And he's still alive, he's not so well. But he was the day-to-day Rosh Yeshiva. Now, every year, Reb Rotman would go to America to recruit boys and to fundraise and to have the dinner. And he would go for 3 or 4 weeks at a time. Now, of course, this was very difficult for him to be away from his wife and family for so long, every year for 3-4 weeks. But he did it. That's what was needed. One time, Reb Rotman, he calls Reb Kreisworth, the Nasi of Yeshiva, who's still in Antwerp, and he says, Shiva, I'm in America. I'm here on, you know, yeshiva business. I'm here for my annual trip. Would it be okay if I buy my wife a dress? I feel bad for her. You know, I'm away for so long, and I want to show my, you know, Hakar Satov to her. She lets me go for so long. Would it be okay if I buy my wife a dress? So Kreisworth said, for sure. You're being wasting efforts for yeshiva. You're going away for so long. Take yeshiva money. Buy your wife a dress. What? I wasn't asking about yeshiva money. I wanted to know, is it okay if I take an hour of yeshiva's time to go down to the shop and to buy a dress? It didn't occur to me to use yeshiva money. Why? Chas v'shalom. Who of us thinks like that? To use the yeshiva's time, because I'm there on yeshiva's business, yeah, it's a different level. Said Reb Zilberstein, the chatchila, he said the boy did not do the correct thing, and it wasn't straight. It wasn't straight. However, but the Eved, he said that it's mutter. He does not need to disclose for various reasons. The first reason is very interesting. The first reason, if you look at your sheet, paragraph number C, it's a halacha I don't really tell the boys. You'll see why in a second. Because the halacha says the following. I'm jumping now to the Ramah. The Ramah says, does a young man, indeed a young woman, who wants to get engaged, and the parents don't like it, they don't want the shidduch, how does it work? Does the child have to listen to his parents? Okay? Says the Ramah, Mefurish, and Shulchan Aruch, and Yeredeh, Simen Reish Mem, Sif Chaf Aleph, says the Ramah, V'chein im ha'av meichir beben lissa eze isha sheyachbetz, if the father protests that he doesn't want his son to marry a certain young lady, sheyachbetz bar ben, and the young man wants to marry her, ein sorich lishmoya el ha'av, he doesn't need to listen to the father. Now's not the time to go into it. It's an interesting topic. Why don't you have to listen to the parents? Okay, because there are parameters to kibud av ve'eim. Yeah, you'd agree that if, for example, the young man passes his driving test, and let's say he comes home and he says, I've saved up for all the years and I'm now going to buy a car. And the parents say, fine, you can buy a car, but I insist it has to be a yellow car. Well, that's not kibud av ve'eim. There are limits to when you have to listen to parents, when you don't have to listen to parents. And here's one example. I always, when this halacha would come up, I always tell the young men, and yeah, it would be very wise to listen to them, yeah, because they have your best, etc., etc. But misad halacha, they don't need to. So therefore, said Reb Zilberstein, this shidduch is between the two of them, halachically speaking. And therefore, if they decide they want to get married, they can get married. They don't need the father-in-law's permission, as it were, and therefore his insistence on seeing his handwriting is unnecessary. That's one. Number two, he said, sort of as a cute insight, he said, look what happened to Besuel when he tried to interfere in the shidduch of Yitzchak and Rivka. So therefore, it's not so clever to start interfering. Yeah, he didn't make it. and therefore best to leave it. Number three, a very interesting Mishnah in the Dorim. There is a Mishnah in the Dorim which says the following. If you look at paragraph three, the Mishnah in the Dorim says as follows. Noidrin laharogin v'lacharomim v'lamoichzin. A very strange case. A person breaks into your house. You've got a bowl of fruit on the table. And this guy has come to steal the fruit. That's what he wants to do. And not only would he steal it, he might even kill to get this fruit. So you're a quick-thinking person, and you make the following cheshbon. You say, I'm going to make a neder. You say to this guy, don't touch the fruit. Before you take it, I want to tell you something. I promise you, this fruit is trumas and maestrus. And therefore, it doesn't help you. Because you're not a kohen, you're not a levi, you can't eat it. So this fruit, I promise you, is trumas and maestrus. And if I'm lying, then all the fruit in the world should be osa for me. Says the Mishnah in the Dorim, it's the neder works. It's a good neder, even though it's sheker, because the fruit is not trumas and maestrus. You're just doing it to deter this guy from stealing the fruit. Now, if you just think about it for a second, it's the crazy scenario. You know, you've got a fellow who's prepared to steal, who's even prepared to murder to steal this, but you tell him, by the way, trumas and maestrus. Ooh, trumas and maestrus. Yeah. When it comes to trumas and maestrus, I'm very firm. Yeah. If you look at the Rosh, that's how the Rosh explains it in the first pshat. Yeah, afak of the kot, he says the Rosh, for God, even the guy murders and steals, loyochli surah, when it comes to hashgoch, it's very careful. Yeah, inami, alternatively, the reason why it deters him is because ein nechshav beinem ki bedomim watim yiknu har betruma, because it's very cheap, there's not much of a market for it, therefore it's not worth his while. Okay, different pshat. But either way, you see from this case, there's a precedent that a person can lie if in the case of an injustice. You're stealing my fruit, that's not allowed. So therefore a person is allowed to sort of lie, as it were, to make a neder, even though it's not true, the stuff is not true, Meiser, in order to prevent some sort of injustice. So therefore, says in Zilberstein, same thing here. A guy can lie. He says, yeah, okay, if he did it, not Lechatchili shouldn't have done it. But the Eved, if he turns around and says, I promise you, this is my handwriting, where he intimates, this is his handwriting, then, if it would prevent an injustice, what's the injustice? That he submits his own handwriting, and the father-in-law doesn't like it, and he might sort of try and put a stop to the shidduch, which is an injustice. Is it not rational? So therefore, he says that's a riot that he's allowed to do it. One final explanation as to why it might be allowed as well is this. Very interesting example. There is quite a well-known Tiferes Yisrael. It's quite controversial because not everyone agrees that it's really true. But the Tiferes Yisrael brings it in the end of Maseches Kiddushin. And he tells the following story. At the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim, there was a non-Jewish king who was king of a nearby nation. And he, of course, heard about Yetzias Mitzrayim. He heard about Moshe Rabbeinu bringing Bnei Yisrael out. And he said, this fellow must be the most amazing person. Who is he? That a single slave wasn't able to leave Mitzrayim, and yet this fellow has taken out millions of people. Furthermore, he's decimated them. The Esemachus, the Kriyas Yamsuf, and then he's taking them out into a wilderness and he's providing them mon and water. Who is he? I want to find out more about him. So what does he do? He hires a brilliant artist from his kingdom to go into the Jewish camp and to take a portrait of Moshe Rabbeinu. And that's what he does. He goes into the Machane Yisrael, and he goes in, he finds out who Moshe Rabbeinu is, and he says, he sketches a picture of him, and he goes home, he does a portrait, and he comes along with this amazing picture of Moshe Rabbeinu. The king then sees the picture, he then gets an expert, one of his advisors, who's an expert in the Chochmas HaParsuf. He can look at a person's face, and he can tell you everything about that person. So he gets this fellow in, and he says, tell me about this person. And he points to the picture of Moshe Rabbeinu. And the guy looks at it and says, "Ooh, terrible. This guy has got every bad middah that you can imagine. Terrible character traits." So the fellow says, "I don't understand. I've heard that this person is a big tzaddik. He's a very righteous person. There's something wrong here. Either the portrait is not accurate, or you can't interpret the portrait." So he goes back to the artist. Is this what he looked like? Yeah. He goes back to the advisor, this is what the interpretation is. So the fellow is so bemused that the king himself, he goes into Machane Yisrael and he seeks out Moshe Rabbeinu. And he says, listen, I hope you don't mind, but I need to ask you.
this is a portrait of you. I can see it looks like you. My advisor tells me that you've got terrible character traits, but that's not what I'm hearing. What's the story? So Moshe Rabbeinu said, the picture is accurate and your advisor is correct. I had bad character traits, but I've worked on my midas that I've changed my character traits that I used to be that, but I'm not that anymore. That's what the Tiferes Yisrael brings, a story at the end of Maseches Kiddushin. Fine. Others dispute it. Where did he get it from? Okay. But that's what the Tiferes Yisrael brings at the end of Maseches Kiddushin. Says Reb Zilberstein. So the guy writes, and he submits his handwriting. And let's say it doesn't portray the most favorable impression of him. But that doesn't necessarily prove that's who he is today. Maybe that's, you know, since sixth form, he was writing, he's been writing exactly the same way, but he's a better person now. He's a more refined person, he's got better middos, etc., etc. So therefore, it doesn't necessarily tell me anything about who the chosn is today. So therefore, for those reasons, Rav Zilberstein says that Lechatchila, he certainly should have disclosed. It wasn't MS what he did. But however, right now, where he is today, he does not have to disclose the information, and he can keep it a secret. For those four reasons. Okay. So you were all right, because it's mutter and it's awesome. Let's press on. We've got a few more pieces to go.
What's the connection with the Sedra?
Oh, so the connection with the Sedra is the Medrash. The Medrash at the beginning, the first Medrash, the Medrash says, it quotes a Kossack from Mishlei, it says, Ish emunos rav brachos. And it says that Ish emunos is Moshe Rabbeinu. At the beginning of the Parsha, Moshe Rabbeinu has to give a reckoning of every single penny used in the Mishkan. Everything. Now, even though Moshe Rabbeinu, Bezalel, and all the other personalities, their stature was indisputable. They were of the highest quality. But yet, they had to sort of go beyond and give a sort of some sort of proof as to their ne'emonos. That's the connection. No, not bad. Okay. Fine. Next thing. There's a famous Rashi in the Parsha. You know, sometimes in school, you hear boys, they come and tell you, you know, in Yiddishkeit, we're living life in a straitjacket. We've all got to keep Shabbos, we've all got to do this, we've got to do that. There's no area to express our individuality. Okay, so take a look at this Rashi. Interesting Taina. It's a well-known Rashi. The Rashi at the bottom of the page, paragraph 2. Ubetzalel ben Uri also es kol asher tziva Hashem es Moshe. Says Rashi, asher tziva Moshe ein ksiv kan. Doesn't say asher tziva Moshe. Ela kol asher tziva Hashem es Moshe. The Bezalel did everything that he had told Moshe. What does that mean? Afilu dvarim shelo yom alei rabbi. Even things which Moshe hadn't told Bezalel, even that he did. His schema died, and he agreed to what he did. The Mashanema, the Moshe B'Sinai, the Moshe B'Tzalel was able to sort of to intuitively understand what HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe. Ki Moshe Tzivah LeBetzalel La'asos Tzachila Kelim, that Moshe Rabbeinu told Betzalel, first you make the Kelim for the Mishkan, V'achakach Mishkan, and then you build the Mishkan. Omelei Betzalel said to him, that's not how it works. Min HaKa'ilam La'asos Tzachila Bayis, first of all you build the house, and then you put the kelim inside the house. Then you put the vessels inside. You don't start building and you know, put the settee over here, and I'm going to put the dishwasher over there, and then you start building the house. No, you build the structure of the house first, and then you put the kelim in. On Malay, so Moshe Rabbeinu said, you're quite right. That's how I heard it from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that you build the house first, and then you put the kelim in. And Omele Moshe, Moshe Rabbeinu said, but Tzel Kel HaYiso, you must have been in the shadow of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you must have been there. Ki bevadai kach tzivli HaKadosh Baruch Hu, v'chein osa ha-mishkan t'chila, v'achach osa kelim. And that's in fact what he did. He did the kelim, the mishkan first, and then the kelim. Now, what's going on? Moshe Rabbeinu told him, first you build the kelim, and then the mishkan, but Bezalel did the other way around. How do you explain the dialogue? So Rav Harman explained that the Maharal says the following pshat. Everyone sees things through their own prism, through their own perspective. Moshe Rabbeinu understood the lomdus of the Mishkan. He understood what the Mizbeach was, what the Menorah was, what the Shulchan was. And therefore for him, the Ikkah were the Kelim. So he said, he saw it through his own perspective. This is the Ikkah, build the Kelim, this is the Mishnah, this is the Mizbeach, this is the Menorah. He explains him in that way. But the Tafkid, if you like, of the whole function of Bezalel was a practical one, to actually build it. So the way he interpreted the same tzivui was the other way around. The point is that you can see exactly the same thing, but you see it through your own perspective, through your own connection to it. I'll give you a moshel. Yeah? Imagine you watch people play chess. Now, people play chess in different ways. Some people have very attacking styles. Some people are very defensive. People like this approach. But it's the same moves. The pawn can only go that way, and the knight can only go that way, and the bishop this way. It's the same moves. It's just that you can express yourself within this structure of the game of chess. Football. It's the same rules. You can't pick up the ball and run with it. You've got to kick it. And there's lots of other rules. But everyone plays in a slightly different way. Handwriting. This is what an A looks like. This is what a B looks like. But everyone expresses in a different way. What Rashi is telling us is that people can interpret their own connection to this mitzvah in their own very individualistic style. And that really is the retort to the young men who expressed that to me. Okay. Let's move on. There's a remarkable Balaturim in the parsha. This I heard from Diane Ehrentrop. Take a look at paragraph 3. We'll quickly do this Balaturim together. The Balaturim says as follows. Kasher tziva Hashem es Moshe. Ksiv al kol dova v'dova. You'll see in the Sedrim of Shem on Shabbos, this phrase, Kasher tziva Hashem es Moshe, repeats itself many, many times. Says the Balaturim, Keneged mashlem Moshe mechinin on mesifrecho, etc. Harbel haskirei. Says the Balaturim, the second line. V'heim yudches pa'omim, Kasher tziva Hashem es Moshe. This phrase, Kasher tziva Hashem es Moshe, repeats itself, or the similar type of phrase, 18 times. Why? V'chol asher tziva Hashem Moshe, all that type of expression. U'kenegdom tiknu yudches brachas. Keneged those yudches times that it says, Kasher tziva Hashem es Moshe, or the like, Chazal u'mesakin shmone esrei, the yudches brachas. Furthermore, the echot kasher tziva Hashem es Moshe kein osu v'tignu keneged birchas haminim. For that extra, slightly different lashon, they were mesak in the 19th brach of v'lamal shinim. Furthermore, v'yesh bohem kuf yud gimel tevis. Of those, of all the words of all these different types of phrases, it comes to 113 words. So, of all these different phrases, kasher tziva Hashem es Moshe, etc., etc., 18 times comes 113 words. I said this to the girls this morning in school. I said, and what's special about the number 113? And they said to me, well, that's the bus that takes us to school. Yeah? Which is not what I was getting at, right? It's true though. Yeah? What's special about 113? 113 is special because the end brachas in Shmoneh Esrei, Baruch Atah Hashem Mogen Avraham, Baruch Atah Hashem Mechayem Meisim, if you add up the words of the end brachas in Shmoneh Esrei, also comes to 113. So what you see is this. There seems to be a connection between the Mishkan and Tfilah. There are 18 times where it says in this week's parsha, Kasher Tziva Hashem es Moshe. Keneged that is the 18 Shmona Esrei. The extra 19 times is Keneged V'lam HaShinim. The 113 words used in Kasher Tziva Hashem es Moshe, or that permutation, is Keneged the 113 words used in the Bracha endings of Shmona Esrei. Now, one final piece of the jigsaw is this. The word lev, heart, is also appears 113 times in Chumash. So the link between the Mishkan and Tfilah is lev. The idea, of course, being that the common denominator between the Mishkan, which is a form of service, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and Tfilah, which is another form of service, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is Lev. It's Navodah Shebelev. It needs some sort of heart, it needs some sort of Kavona. That is the link between the two. Okay. Two very quick final points. This I saw in the writings of Mordechai Kamenetsky, the grandson of Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. He says a very interesting point from Yonis and Ibershitz. Again, we said earlier that in the Parsha, the Moshe Rabbeinu has to delineate where every single penny went. So it says that the main metals that were used, that were given, that were donated, were gold, silver, and copper. And if you look at the Pesukim, something very strange happens. Take a look at Pasuk Chaf Dalet in paragraph 4. Kol ha-zohav ha-osu le-melocha, b'chol melech sa-kodesh, etc., etc. It says how much gold was given. Next Pasuk. For kesef pikudei ha-edo, Meas kikov, elef, etc., etc. Again, it tells you how much silver was given. And then in Pasuk Chavtes, it tells me how much copper was given. But the difference between the three, the gold, the silver, and the copper, is this.
When it comes to the kesef, the silver, and when it comes to the nechoshes, it tells me exactly what it was used for. But when it comes to the gold, in Pasuk Chaf Dalet, it doesn't say what it was used for. It doesn't give me this sort of breakdown of where I'm using the silver, where I'm using the copper. It doesn't say that for the gold. Why not? So, Rav Yonis Leibish says the following, but I'll preface it with an anecdote that Rav Mordechai Kamenetsky gives. He's a Rosh Shiva in America. It's a Rosh Shiva with various institutions and buildings, and it's quite a big operation. And, of course, a lot of his job is fundraising. So one time, an older man sends in a check to his institution for $5. Okay, fine. It was a small donation, he sends his check for. The next day he gets a phone call. He said, tell me, did you get my check? Yeah, thank you very much, very kind of you, etc. So tell me, what projects are you going to use it for? The $5 check. I don't know, we've got quite a big budget here. We have 700 boys. There is a $6 million budget. We'll think of ways how to use it. Thank you. We'll think of ways. He said, okay, fine. I'll leave it to you. But please make sure we write a letter of acknowledgement because the check was in memory of a certain person. And I'd like you to write a letter of acknowledgement to his widow, to his amona, plus the three sons. So Kamenetsky was biting his lip, but he was, the postage is going to cost more than the donation. Right? But that's what he's thinking. A few days later, he gets a check in the post for another source, $10,000. $10,000, a nice sizable amount. He calls the fellow, and he says, thank you very much, it's very kind of you, we very much appreciate it. Is there any particular area you'd like us to use the money for? So the fellow says, listen, you've got 700 boys in your yeshiva, you've got a budget of $6 million, you'll figure out how to use the money. Sometimes, says Rav Yonis Leibishitz, when a person gives large sums, gives a golden donation, he gives it in a way that, listen, I'm not going to tell you how to use the money. You'll figure it out. But when a person gives a smaller donation, I want to know that you can use it for this, how you're going to use it. I need to have some sort of clarification. That's why, says Rav Yonis Leibishitz, when it comes to the silver, when it comes to nechoshes, there's clear delineation of what the money was used for. When it comes to the gold, silence. Yeah, he finishes off the article and he says, silence is golden, but golden is also silent. That's what he says. Okay, one final point. The mice have taken a bit of a liberty because it's not really on this week's parasha, but as I said, we've come to the end of the whole series of parashas about the Mishkan, and it's such a beautiful idea that I thought I'd slip it in. It's something I heard from Malcolm Herman, who heard it in the name of Dan Abramsky. An amazing idea. When the Torah lists the kelim used in the Mishkan, there is a difference between one lot of kelim and all the rest. All the kelim were made l'doiros. The menorah, the shulchan, all the kelim were made for all time. The one exception were the chatzotzeris, the trumpets. They were made for each dor, which is a strange thing. How exactly it worked? Maybe when the Kohen Gadol died, they buried the chatzotzeris with the Kohen Gadol, but they had to be remade each generation. Why? Why is it all the other kelim were the doiros, but the chatzotzeris had to be remade every generation? Said Dan Abramsky, the most amazing idea. You know, if you think about our own schooling, perhaps two generations ago, the norm in a classroom is to have a blackboard, and the teacher would write with chalk. The next generation, you'd have a whiteboard, and the teacher would write with a black felt marker. Now, in our generation, we have interactive whiteboards. We have smart boards. You're sitting typing something, and it appears, on the thing. The message that we're conveying to our children is the same message, the Bob Metzia we're learning with our kids, is the same Bob Metzia we learned last year, 2 years ago. It's the same message, it's the same Torah. But the method of communication has to change. That's the point. That is what the Chatzotzeros are. The Chatzotzeros is the call to bring the people together. It's the PR system. So the Chatzotzeros represent this very point. The message of Torah is eternal. It's the same message we're transmitting der after der after der. But the means of communication, the way in which we transmit the message, that has to change for each dor. That's the one. And therefore, the chatzros has to be made again, afresh, for every single generation. Okay, we'll leave it there.